Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, as truthful as resources permit. Jazza, would you like me to start this podcast?
Ah, you can start that again, thank you. How embarrassing.
Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, as truthful as resources permit. Jazza, would you like me to restart this podcast by sharing some audience feedback with you?
Yeah.
Yeah. This is aimed very specifically at you, I should say.
What a fucking surprise, Jimmy. Go on.
I mean, yeah, if it was, you know, mean to me, we wouldn't be talking.
No,
about
of course not.
So we've had a mystery patron recently sign up, which you can do so by going to patreon.com/rightdishonourable if you're interested. This is from he or she only goes by the name T. Mm-hmm. So very mysterious figure, I would say. And
hello, they... T. Thank you for the money.
And alongside the pledge, they've sent a message to us. And I quote, "Honestly, with Jazz's terrible pronunciation, I could swear he doesn't even speak Mandarin."
Well, I'd love to know what he thinks I'm unable to pronounce, because I do speak Mandarin and I probably pronounce it correctly. Just saying. I am that confident in my pronunciation of Chinese things that I'm probably correct.
That was a very bullish response.
Yeah. I mean, come for me for like relevant things, D. But if you're going to come for my Chinese pronunciation, that's on you.
I mean, that this is cowardly behavior, I would say, hiding behind a single letter of the alphabet, not even revealing full name.
No. You be as anonymous as you want, T, as long as you continue to support us on Patreon. We support you, as you support us.
There are some Chinese characters after his English message. Their English message, I should say.
Oh.
But I can't read Chinese of any sort.
Oh, and I'm not looking at the screen now, so
yeah, this
that's
is
annoying, isn't it?
Yeah, very awkward. yeah, thank you very much for the pledge. I've slightly derailed us here, because we're not going to be talking about
you
anything
have.
related to that.
What have you done?
But we always like to share audience feedback on the podcast, show we're engaged.
Yeah.
Engaged with us.
Especially when is pejorative for the other host.
Absolutely.
Generally, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. So we meet every so often, every 2 to 3 weeks, to talk about politics, current affairs, and social issues. For the first subject, Jazza, we're going to be talking about the UK's approach to Ukrainian refugees in the wake of the war.
Yes.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about what's been going on that front?
Well, Priti Patel, as Home Secretary, was in charge of it for a long time, which essentially dooms anything to being mismanaged and an absolute shit show. She then had our response to the Ukrainian refugee crisis taken away from her because it was next to impossible for people to actually apply for refugee status from where they were being displaced. And instead has been put on the desk of the Levelling Up Secretary, which I hate that that's a department now. Michael Gove is now in charge of our response to the Ukrainian refugee crisis. Makes total sense. He is touted often as a get things done minister.
He has previously got things done.
He has it's previously just a question got things done.
Of whether they were the right things to be getting done.
Correct. give him a brief and he'll do it at the very least. But he announced last week the Homes for Ukraine scheme, where big-hearted Brits, who obviously have a long history of welcoming refugees in this country.
I don't know why you're saying this in a sarcastic manner, Jazza.
Mm-hmm. Honestly, I've done too much reading about the history of the UK with refugees for me to not say that sarcastically. There is now a scheme where if you know a Ukrainian person who has fled the conflict in Ukraine by name, then you apply alongside them for them to come and live in your house.
What's wrong with that, Jazza?
We'll talk about it. What else are we talking about?
The second topic, appropriately enough, we're going to be talking about MPs' second jobs.
Oh.
So this was a reform that was mooted after the Owen Paterson scandal last year, which everyone covered in a great deal of depth because it was very scandalous.
Basically, he was being bribed. But somehow that it's being classed as like, oh, he had a second job. It's like, no, he was using the mechanisms in Parliament to basically make his bribe okay.
Yeah,
by being a second job.
He was doing, I think, paid advocacy is often the, or consultancy. Those are the kind of euphemisms that are used to describe that sort of behaviour.
Do I have to say allegedly bribed?
I don't think so.
Excellent. He was bribed!
If Owen Paterson is listening and wishes to sue us, it would be excellent publicity for the podcast.
Oh my God, so. Yeah. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
Come at us, Owen.
Of all the people that have slagged him off over the last year or so, just picking on poor little us. But yeah, so after that happened, they said that they were going to impose or were going to consider some sort of limit on the amount of work that MPs could do alongside their jobs. And now they've decided that one of the potential limits, which would be a cap on time, so a limit to 15 hours a week, was given around the time of the original plans were being drawn up. That's no longer going to happen, basically.
Which is something like a day and a half, 2 days work, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, you'd have thought with the amount of work that MPs are expected to do in terms of, you know, legislative scrutiny and all the constituency work and all the rest of it, you'd have thought 15 hours have been quite hard to come by in your average week. But apparently it's impractical to put caps on the amount of time, according to the government. So it's now not entirely clear what... I mean, there may be some rules around paid advocacy, i.e. taking bribes and then lobbying for particular companies. But it does look as though they're rowing very far back on what the initial proposals looked like. And there's definitely been a big pushback from particularly Conservative MPs who are not happy about the idea of limiting their extracurricular activities, let's say.
Surprisingly, I mean, I'm shocked. The vast majority of those with second jobs in the lower chamber are Conservative MPs. So about 90 Conservative MPs undertake paid work every year in addition to their job in Parliament. And by contrast, about three Labour MPs.
Still about three.
Yeah, it's about three, but it is exactly three.
So we're going to be discussing that. What do you think about that? I'm sure Jazz is going to come out in favour of generous second jobs for MPs. You know, they don't earn enough money anyway. Speaking of people who own a lot of money and own a lot of things, we're going to be discussing the Roman Abramovich story, which has been rolling on for the last couple of weeks. Initially, it looked as though he's the owner of Chelsea Football Club, obviously. And it initially looked as though he was trying to step back from the club, sort of put it in a kind of blind trust-esque arrangement where he, you know, distanced himself from the day-to-day running of the club. And then he put up plans to sell the club, and then the government sanctioned him and said that he couldn't profit from any of the club's ongoing activities or the sale of the club. So it's been a pretty rough time for him, but it does very much shine a light on the Premiership's pretty questionable history of allowing not the most salubrious of foreign owners to come in and buy up football clubs and launder their reputations that way. And although, you know, I personally do kind of approve of the actions they've taken against Abramovich most recently, I do think that a lot of these problems have been very, very public for a very long time, and it does seem slightly opportunistic and a slight arse-saving exercise, I would say. But we're going to be discussing the ethics around that, and I guess, Jazza, as a Tottenham fan, you're going to be doing some gloating as well.
Yeah. It's always nice. Alright, shall we beg for money and then go into this episode?
Yeah, let's do it.
Lovely. Hello, dear friends. Jazza here, just popping on quickly to remind you that we are a podcast completely funded by listeners like you. Without you, we'd be really out of pocket with the overheads of running a podcast. It's surprisingly expensive, there are a group of you who support us every episode so that we can keep on bringing these meandering chants into your ear canals. So thank you so much to Gemma, Matt, John, Michael, Andrew, Aeterna, David, Alexander, Jer, Nick, Marlene, Seb, Ilona, and of course our newest patron who we talked about in the intro, T, the Mysterious T. If you would like to join the Mysterious T, then just go to Mike Dishonorable on Patreon and you can support the show for as little as a dollar an episode. Right, that's it then. Back to the show. So, Jimmy, would you class yourself as a big-hearted Brit?
I don't think so. I think my heart's probably quite average size.
No, it hasn't grown two sizes larger.
I mean, that would be worrying, I think. I should get it checked out if it happens.
It would be. I believe that's a symptom of COVID as well, isn't it? Or like long COVID, people's hearts swelling. I don't know. if your heart is growing, please get it seen to by a professional. So you're not planning on signing up to house a Ukrainian refugee for up to 6 months with a generous fee of £350 from the government?
Well, I don't want to pour even more scorn on the Tory government than has already been poured, but they've been in power for 12 years and they've still not really done a great deal to address the housing crisis. So, frankly, I don't really have the space, apart from anything else.
Oh, shots have indeed been fired. The refugee kind of like embarrassment, and it is an embarrassment that I feel towards it, started with the huge disparities between the numbers of refugees being accepted by the UK and then with other parts of Europe, primarily EU states. The EU generally has waived all visa necessity for those with a Ukrainian passport, which seems sensible, especially as there's over a million people, I think it's well above that now, who have gone into Poland alone.
Even prior to the war, if you're a Ukrainian citizen, you didn't need a visa to enter the EU. Mm-hmm. Like you could stay for up to, 90 days or something?
It's often something like that, isn't it? Yeah.
It might have been less than that, but my understanding is you didn't need a visa anyway. They just increased the amount of time you could stay for. Mm-hmm. It's a matter of,
But we're now one of the only states in Europe who has visa requirements, and you need to apply to arrive in the UK. Mm. That to me, and so it resulted in us, in terms of absolute numbers, but primarily per capita, taking one of the lowest numbers of refugees from Ukraine, even compared to other far-flung Western islands. Such as Ireland, which I can tell it does not border Ukraine, is not close, and has still managed to take more per capita than we have. However, we kept on being told, this is the thing that really rubbed me up the wrong way, was continuously being told, and this being parroted by conservatives, that we have a proud history of helping refugees in the darkest times. I'm fed up with being lied to and that rhetoric being shoved back in my face, because actually I was really proud of especially kind of like the way that we dealt with refugees in World War II, for example, with kinder transport. And then I was forced by Dominic Raab saying it in Parliament to go and research the kinder transport, and it was shit. And so now I can't be proud anymore.
What I heard about the kinder transports is that part of the reason it was focused on children is that British people
are racist.
Generally didn't want to take in Jewish adults.
Correct. And so we had to separate children from their families, many of whom never got to see their families again because they were killed in the Holocaust. Now, fantastic that we took those children and those children were saved. Only about 10,000 people. by the way, overall. But they... Why didn't we save their fucking families?
Because, you know, British people in the 1940s didn't really like Jewish people.
Yeah, horrific. And so I'm not even allowed to think of that fondly. And so the things that I'm allowed to be proud of for being British and English are ever diminishing. We'll talk about football later.
So you don't think we do have a proud history of taking in refugees then, aside from the Uganda crisis?
Yeah, the stuff like Uganda, yeah, Hong Kong, we'll see, but seems to have been received reasonably well. But those instances are few and far between. Otherwise, I just see things as being incredibly embarrassing. I can't think of another way of interpreting the way that everything was being dithered when the invasion first started and the numbers of people pouring out of Ukraine began. I can't think of any other motive from Peter Patel of fucking it up so much, other than trying to deliberately stall the UK being an option until the majority of people who are going to flee the country have fled the country. Because if they at the beginning of the conflict have the option of going to Poland, Germany, Sweden, or the UK, and the UK isn't an option yet because the visa systems are so poorly managed, then they're going to choose one of the other countries, and so it means that we never have to deal with them.
So I was listening to the Spectator podcast earlier today.
Oh dear.
And well, I think it's useful because, you know, Boris Johnson used to edit The Spectator.
Yes.
They're clearly very close to the government. I mean, James Forsyth, the political editor, is married to Allegra Stratton, who was obviously the spokesperson. So, I mean, they're very, very closely intertwined, I would say. Mm. And they were saying that, they're actually on migration. It's a relatively liberal magazine. They're quite pro it, by and large. And they said that part of the reason for the reticence about Ukrainian refugees is that Boris Johnson's government is pursuing a strategy of keeping migration as low as possible because it believes that will in some ways lead to wage inflation for, you know, particularly for people who do maybe slightly lower skilled jobs, the kind of people that are more immediately impacted by competition from foreign labour, basically. So, before that, it was actually a bit bemusing to see the UK government doing what it was doing because there seemed, if you sort of look at opinion polls and stuff, it seems like most British people want the UK to take in Ukrainian refugees.
It's like over 80% are in favour of us taking more refugees.
So it seems there's just been a lot of stuff over the past 2 and a bit years or whatever it is of Boris Johnson's government just doing stuff that just doesn't really make any sense, even from their own narrow political strategy point of view. Just like very self-defeating policies. And you know, I know you mentioned Priti Patel in particular, but I think it is a wider thing within the government. And she's clearly been tasked with keeping migration numbers low, or at least being seen to do so. So you know, while I think it's fair enough to criticise her personally, I do think it is a wider government thing, basically.
You've waded into the Priti Patel incompetence thing. People have criticised the criticism of her, of the fact that she is from a displaced community.
Her parents were asylum seekers.
To the UK. And people have criticised the criticism of her pulling up the ladder.
Specifically, people have said that if you criticise Priti Patel, basically saying, oh, look, she's a second-generation migrant and she's opposed to migration, people say that that's a racist criticism, and, you know, to criticise her for her policy stance. And they say, and, you know, she's not obliged to hold any political views, you know, just because she's...
Because of her background.
Yeah, just because of her background. So that much is true. But I think the Conservative attempts to try and pin all, like, criticism about her as racist or misogynistic, you know, apart from anything else, I think it's just very unwise to go down that route for them because, you know, the Tories are always more plausible targets for bigotry accusations, mm-hmm. just because of their political positioning. And so doing what the left do to them all the time, you know, I can sort of see the impulse, but I just don't think it makes any sense. But more importantly than that, I just don't think it's true in the case of Priti Patel. I just think that there's a lot of left-wing voices out there who are very, very pro-migration and who genuinely really dislike her policy stance in this area, you know, to do with detention centres for, you know, asylum seekers, the channel crossings as well, and, you know, more recently the Ukraine stuff. A lot of people are just criticising her because they don't like the policies. But I think that, you know, her family has benefited from, the more liberal aspects of UK migration policy over the years. I think it's a pertinent criticism to say, look, your family benefited from this and then you're opposing it. You know, I don't think it's like a killer political argument, but it is an inevitable political argument that people will make, in the same way that if me or you were politicians, Jazz, and we said, I think we should close all private schools.
Oh, God help us.
People would say, well, you benefited from private schools and now you're trying to shut it down. You're pulling up the ladder behind you. That criticism would inevitably happen. Mm-hmm. And it's an ad hominem attack, so logically I don't think it works. But politically it's very potent, and you can't just dismiss it out of hand, I don't think.
Mm-hmm. And it is possible for Priti Patel to be both evil and incompetent. the two are not mutually exclusive. So after it seemed that the Home Office and Priti Patel were pretty much incapable of speeding up some kind of proper response to the refugees coming out of Ukraine, Michael Gove created Homes for Ukraine, a program where you scroll through Instagram, find a Ukrainian family that you like, and go, hey, do you want to crash at mine for 6 months?
You don't think this is a good idea?
No.
How would you do it, Jazza, if you were designing the refugee program?
Oh, I'd maybe have kind of like funded housing for them, where they are supported, where they're not put in people's spare rooms, where we have to. I'm really worried that there is inevitably going to be some kind of a scandal where a background check has slipped through. Because the background checks are not rigorous. I'm worried that about, especially because it's women and children who have left Ukraine. I'm worried that that is going to be exploited. The people who are very generalistically saying, you know what, the kids are away at uni, why don't we just use their bedroom and give it to a family that really needs it? I think that is really, really honourable. But they are not equipped. A normal family in, like, Lincolnshire are not equipped to support a family who have gone through war, who are probably traumatised. We have no idea how they've been affected by this. Are they going to have medical support while they're here? Are they going to be able to have kind of like communities? Is there going to be language support so that Ukrainians are going to be able to converse with the people that they're living with? It seems absolutely stupid to outsource this to people who mean really well.
But that sort of thing is happening in Poland already, isn't it? There's a lot of Polish families taking in Ukrainian refugees.
Yeah, there is, but there's also a huge amount of support on the ground. There's like camps of people. I have friends who are volunteering in distribution of kind of like healthcare and provisions and all of that kind of stuff in Poland. I haven't seen anything, and also because the refugees are already there, like they've kind of had to have a quick, rapid response to this, because there's over 1 million refugees who are in Poland at the moment, and so they kind of have to be a little bit ad hoc about it.
You don't think there's a case for us being a little bit ad hoc about it, given the nature of the crisis?
I think that using private people's homes is a really limited way of it's a really short-sighted way, and I think is meant to make good headlines rather than actually be practical. I think that they should be instead seizing like hotels and using hotels or kind of like places that aren't places that don't have residences at the moment, that vacant flats and stuff like that. They should be using that, not putting them in people's spare rooms.
So speaking of ad hoc solutions, we both saw this story about David Cameron doing his bit in the war effort by driving a van containing supplies for Ukrainian refugees to Poland. What do you make of that as a gesture?
Why are you tweeting about it, mate? I just don't want him to tweet about it.
He's trying to encourage other people to do their bit. So he's
so saying, other people should drive vans to Poland?
Probably not.
You know what? If he's at least consistent. It's very big society, isn't it?
I mean, I suppose you could say the government's Homes for Ukraine program is big society, isn't it? It's about you know, civil society doing its bit on a more ad hoc, localized basis.
Mm-hmm. Do you have an opinion on any of this? There was a really weird thing. We both read the article on the BBC about that guy from Blackpool, right? What was his name? Max Fox, the BBC spoke to, who had flown out to Poland, basically, it sounds like, to go shopping for a refugee that he'd quite like. He said that, it's important that you have a personal connection that you click. I think that's really important. These are refugees. They're not like an accessory or a new flatmate for you. I thought that was such a weird article.
I thought it was exceedingly bizarre. And you know, it, obviously you have to applaud his willingness to actually open his home to a refugee. That you know, that's honourable intentions,
of course,
in
yeah.
its own way. But the yeah,
flying out to Poland and basically, what are you doing? Like interviews.
Which, yeah, it's bizarre, isn't it?
It's very strange.
It's very, very strange. I think it is that thing of some of these schemes just seem a bit ill-advised in that, sure, some people will muddle along and they'll figure it out, but there's just ample opportunity for things to go wrong. And I don't think you can just leave it up to ordinary people. I think there has to be, you know, a fairly substantial amount of government coordination. Because I mean, that's why we pay our taxes, right? Is so that we can have a large central organisation that can do that coordinating activity that would be much more difficult on an individual basis.
What do you think of this, of the rhetoric that we keep on hearing from Conservatives in Parliament about how generous the British people are, but then the numbers just not stacking up?
I mean, it is virtue signalling, isn't it? Usually that charge is leveled.
How weird. Yeah, right? How weird.
Yeah, but I suppose it's kind of a patriotic drumbeat, isn't it? It's saying, you know, look at the British, we're so generous.
Well, it's part of the myth that we tell ourselves. It's entwined in World War II again.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that probably quite a lot of them genuinely believe it. I don't know if... And, you know, there have been instances where the British have taken in quite a few refugees, but I don't... I suppose whenever somebody from left or right says something like that, I always kind of think, well, compared to what exactly? Mm. Like, what's the benchmark here for generosity in terms of taking people in? And I mean, you'd have to be totally naive or ignorant not to have noticed the anti-immigrant rhetoric and policies that have been fairly common in the last 10 years. Obviously, played a role in the Brexit referendum.
Mm.
So. I mean, I think all of that stuff is generally guff anyway, but it is interesting that the Tories have decided to do it. And especially given that, you know, I think a part of their electoral appeal is that people trust them to reduce migration or at least to hold it in line to a certain degree.
Mm.
So I don't entirely know what to make of it. You must have seen, on sort of a related point, the people who've criticised the European, and particularly Western European, response to Ukrainian refugees, saying, well, where was this attitude when Syria was in crisis and other similar scenarios? Mm. What do you make of that?
I think it's probably fair.
A lot of commentators I've read, and I think I agree with them, I think it's inevitable to a degree that people are more willing to take in refugees from, I mean, a lot of people have taken a racial angle on it, but I think it's just in terms of people who live lives more similar to yours. I think it's more, it's understandable that that would happen, I think.
Yeah, I think that I think that is true. But I think that that highlights a misgiving and a prejudice that we have in our societies in Western Europe, where that ability to empathize, that ability to mobilize, that willingness to do something is affected by how similar we see the other people being affected by it are. Like,
that
I think you're correct that that is a natural thing to happen. But like, praying mantises eat the heads off of their mates, you know?
Yeah, I mean, natural shouldn't be confused as a synonym for good, yeah. For sure. Mm. I do think there are practical reasons why, you know, if you took in, say, an Afghan refugee from a very different, hesitate to use the word tribal, but I don't really see what alternative there is, background, basically, and tried to...
Oh my God, Jimmy, just say background, from a different background.
Like... Well, no, but like a very very different cultural context from ours, basically, that is more sort of clannish, if you want to use that word. And try and integrate them into Western society versus taking a refugee from Ukraine, for instance. I do think it's easier to integrate and help out a Ukrainian. I think there are fewer cultural barriers there. So I think there's a higher practical cost in many ways to actually taking refugees from more different contexts than yours. So I think there's an element of reasonableness to it, I would say.
I don't know. There was something... because people have remarked on especially Poland and Hungary, which have been particularly hostile to especially Syrian refugees up until this point, as well as others from the Middle East, have been very anti-immigration and xenophobic and homophobic, racist, all of the good stuff up until this point. And then as soon as, I mean, Poland especially, having a very recent history with being controlled by or heavily influenced by Russia, have just opened their doors in order to help the people fleeing. And some of it has been said to be, oh yeah, because Ukrainians are Christian and we are a Christian continent, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like... Well, try finding similarities between Polish Catholicism and Ukrainian Orthodoxy. I mean, there's some very strange things, differences between the two of those ways of interpreting Christianity.
That's well beyond my theological expertise, but I do think that's a fair point. Religious people are quite infamous for falling out with people who have very similar views to them overall, but some small but seemingly important differences.
Yeah.
See the history of Europe, for example.
I mean, I think the history of anywhere, all Abrahamic religions.
Poland is still governed by a Christian nationalist party.
That's correct,
I can't remember the name. It's Justice and something, isn't it?
Yeah, justice and
truth and honour and
bigotry.
Yeah, I mean the contrast is very stark. But I think there may be, if you're sort of generally, you know, pro accepting refugees, pro migration and on the left, I think sometimes you may have to take the victories you can in some of these instances. And I think it's a valid point. I can see why people have made it, but as the phrase goes, there's a danger of making the perfect the enemy of the good in some of these instances.
Oh my God, that's so deep.
That's very deep, isn't it?
Speaking of deep, nope, not at all. This isn't a good segue. Jimmy, how long do you think is reasonable for you to be working on projects outside of your core job?
Well, I mean, in my instance, I think I can work as much as I like out of my core job because I'm not representing people's political interests in Parliament.
How interesting. So you'd be happy to take... No, wait, what's my point?
I mean, put it this way, I'm currently writing for a magazine that covers supermarkets. I think it would be unreasonable for me to work a side gig writing for a direct competitor to that magazine.
Mm-hmm, sure.
But I think...
And you see similarities here with members of parliament taking on second jobs, sometimes earning, in extreme cases, to be fair, but sometimes earning very close to about £1 million per annum.
I think it's unreasonable for an employer to prohibit work that isn't a conflict of interest, mm-hmm. of some sort. So if you're working, for YouTube, for example, Jazza, and you also want to sell cupcakes on the side or something, some sort of baking business, mm. and it doesn't really have any relation to your main job, I think it's illegitimate for your employer to interfere in that in any way. Mm-hmm. But I think that...
Thank God my cupcake business will continue to thrive.
I think, you know, Parliament and being a politician, being a political representative of any sort, is very, very different. And I think the scope for conflicts of interest is just much wider for very obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the case of Owen Paterson, he was obviously taking bribes and lobbying on behalf of his clients. Mm. Clients is probably a slightly nice way of putting that. But... that clear conflict of interest, you know, essentially betrayed the interests of his constituents in doing that. I still think it should be illegal enough that you end up in jail, personally, but that's clearly not going to happen. But if for say he wanted to do a Nadine Dorries and sit down and write some chiclet or, you know, some bodice rippers, is that the right word? You know what I'm saying, some erotica. If he wants to do that in his spare time, that's fine, you know. That doesn't obviously impinge on his political responsibilities, I would say. Mm. So there's probably like some grey area between that of jobs where you could argue one way or the other. So I think the examples we've used previously is if somebody's a trained GP and wants to, I mean, I think you have
well,
to
yeah, you have to continue to do a certain number license. Of hours in order to maintain, the right to have that qualification.
That sort of stuff.
Same with
fine.
Nursing as well and stuff like that.
Yeah, I don't really have a problem. I mean, I guess you could argue that maybe there should be some provision in law that means you don't have to continue practicing to quite the same extent, but you could cut it either way. But you could probably continue to practice law in certain instances, although that's a fairly time intensive job. So I'm not sure how compatible that would be with being an MP, but yeah, there's quite a few jobs that you could just do because they don't really hamper your ability to serve your constituents. But I think overall, like, I mean, they just raised the pay for MPs, didn't they? So it's gone up by a couple of grand. It's
like £81,932.
There you go. That's a lot of money. If you can't, I mean, you should be able to support a family out off that money, to be honest with you. And if you can't, especially given, you know, some of the other benefits of being an MP, such as a second housing allowance and that sort of thing, if you can't, maybe you should do some courses on financial management and work out your personal finances, because that's a, I mean, put it this way, the average salary in the UK, I think, is like £27,000 or something. So that's like three times the average salary in the UK. Mm. That's enough money to live off.
I believe it's something like the top 2% of PAYE earners in the UK.
Right.
Which seems, you know, generous. Obviously, this comes off the back of the Owen Paterson escandalo, where, as we've already said, he was... Accused of breaching the House of Commons advocacy rules, and Boris Johnson tried to change the rules so that Owen Paterson could keep his job, and then everything got a little bit heated, and then Owen Paterson left and said that I can't work under these conditions, and everybody went, well, thank God, goodbye. There were promises of the system changing. The committee that's working on this, on the new rules around the proposed new rules around second jobs for members of parliament, they have like, this is a promise that was made by the government that we are going to bring in these rules and then everything's going to be absolutely fine. This is the government once again going, oh no, we only We only said that. We didn't mean we were going to do anything. You silly plebs, is the vibe that I am getting from this. Although some of the criticism has said of the proposals to limit work to 10 to 15 hours a week, some of the criticism has said that, oh, this is could potentially open up investigations about people who are writing a book or have a radio show or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They're too sweeping and it would stop people from being able to do legitimate work just based on hours. What do you think about those critiques?
Well, I mean, as I said, I think being an MP is much more than a full-time job. And MPs are always complaining about the sheer volume of constituency work they have to do. And where are people finding these spare hours? Like,
I think they just don't do the work that they're meant to do as an MP, Jimmy. Well, like, so Geoffrey Cox famously, Geoffrey Cox famously would vote by proxy the whole time, like when he was out in the Seychelles or wherever he was. Where was it? Jamaica, Bermuda, somewhere sunny.
The Virgin Islands. On a Zoom call for some sort of body there.
Like, he famously just voted by proxy. He's not doing any work, really, is he? And I think the vast majority who are in safe seats don't need to worry about doing work.
I think that probably is true, but I think to be on the kind side to MPs, I think most of them do actually.
Try and
keep on top of constituency work. But I think
I'm just angry at them, Jimmy.
I mean, yeah, as you said, 15 hours for most people—that's a sort of 2 days of working hours. Where are you finding time for anything else? Like, do these people have families and friends that they occasionally see, or are all MPs just such avid workaholics that they really want to cram in, you know, all of the hours they can into your average week? Mm-hmm. I feel like writing a book. Is anyone really going to keep track of like how long it takes to write a book? Like, you could, I don't really think it's going to come up, to be honest. I can see the argument for like why an earnings cap might be potentially difficult if you wrote a book and, you know, like Nadine Dorris, it ends up being a bestseller and you make loads of money out of that. I can see why in certain scenarios that might be a little bit tricky, but in general, I don't think an earnings cap is actually that outlandish. I also just don't see why most MPs need to earn more money. They earn a lot of money. I feel like I keep coming back to this, but sometimes when you read the coverage of this, there's sort of like journalists who seem to think like, oh, well, it's only 80 grand. You know, some of these politicians have friends in the city that are earning millions of pounds a year. And it's like, that's not normal. That's not the benchmark here that you should be anchoring this argument to. You know, it's if money is that important to you, quit your job and go earn more money elsewhere. Mm-hmm.
Jimmy Nichols on the soapbox. This is kind of hot.
I don't know why this issue. I mean, there's lots of issues that wind me off on a low key level, but this just seems to be such an obvious huge amount of bullshit in terms of how this is being discussed. And you know, Owen Paterson was corrupt. He lost his job because he was crooked, you know. And here we are just making excuses for it and dragging our feet as well. And this is before we get into arguments about, you know, the ACOBA Committee on Public Appointments after you leave office and all of the problems therein. To be fair to the government, the other side of the ledger, they are still saying that they're going to restrict jobs that involve paid parliamentary advice, consultancy or strategy services, which means lobbying, basically.
Which is specifically what Owen Paterson was accused of doing.
Yeah, it's what he did. He wasn't just accused of doing it.
It's what he did.
Yeah. It's something that he did that was bad, and then he lost his job in scandal. He's now disgraced, Owen Paterson. It was remiss of us not to mention that in every mention of his name.
Yeah, of course.
So yeah, this is it's bad that they've rowed back on it, but did anyone really expect the Tories to actually deal with this issue properly? I hesitate to quote Peter Hitchens, but he does have a good line on the Conservative Party, it exists primarily to get the sons of gentlemen into high office. or words to that effect. And there's an element where you look at them and you say, yeah, that does appear to be roughly what it means. I mean, you've seen who the Prime Minister is.
That's depressing, isn't it?
Yeah. I do need to get off my soapbox about this.
Private Eye, give him a column.
I mean, yeah, Private Eye, if you are interested in this, Private Eye have done a long line in criticising the Akoba committee and how inept it is. Mm-hmm. So this is very much their bread and butter, and it's worth subscribing to them just so that they print obnoxious articles about corrupt people.
The cartoons are really good as well.
The cartoons are also good. Mm. I was pretending for a second there that isn't the main reason that I buy the magazine.
I only buy it to look like an intellectual.
That's true. Just leave it in strategic locations around your house.
Of course, just scattered tastefully. Sort of thing. Yeah, exactly. Just so that any visitors ask me a question about it.
Okay, speaking of shady people, Jazza, do you want to talk about Chelsea owner Roman Abramovich? And
I'm interested if you can convince me to feel anything other than wonderful schadenfreude.
So, I mean, so Roman Abramovich, just in terms of backstory, he's actually from a relatively humble background, as it were, and he gradually managed to claw his way up Russian society, made a few astute business decisions, particularly during the time that Russia was, you know, the Soviet Union was collapsing. The Russian government was selling off a lot of its public assets to what we would now call oligarchs, so businessmen. And that's how Roman Abramovich made his billions. He was formerly in the Soviet army, interestingly enough. I'm getting a lot of this on Wikipedia, to be honest with you. And he also was in jail for a bit, in a Russian jail, which I thought was kind of interesting. But since making his billions, he's obviously bought Chelsea, and he's spent time in the UK and somewhat laundered his reputation, I would say, through running that club and essentially buying various trophies through, you know, buying loads of players and that sort of thing, which isn't particularly unusual for the Premiership, to be fair. The only way in which I feel slightly sorry for him is it's not that clear for me how much in Putin's good books he is, because I mean, Putin is an absolute madman anyway, and dictators are infamous for falling out with people and having them killed. I'm not entirely sure how well connected he is to Putin's regime. I think I read, you know, a while back that he'd gone back to Russia to try and lobby Putin to stop the war in Ukraine. I'm not sure how true that is, or how seriously to take that in general. But you know, undoubtedly he is being scapegoated to a degree, and it's a very prominent way for the British government to look as though it's taking this whole Ukraine crisis seriously. So to that extent, I guess you can feel sorry for him. But the fact is that he still made a lot of money on slightly, you know, not always entirely good ways of making money. And you know, he's one of those oligarchs that profited from the collapse of the Soviet Union and helped enrich himself, arguably at the expense of Russian people, as would be true of a lot of his peers. And you know, he's very, very rich, and he's going to be fine. He's got like citizenship in Israel and Portugal, oddly enough. I don't think he's going to end up being squirreled away to Siberia by Putin and dying in a gulag somewhere. The fact that he's just lost this huge asset in the form of Chelsea, and he's not going to be able to, because originally I think he was asking for like £3 billion or something for the sale of Chelsea. Mm-hmm. And as I said in the intro, the British government is not allowing him to profit anymore from Chelsea in pretty
much
any way.
Which means that they can't sell. This is the crazy thing. I didn't realise that the sanctions went this far, that Chelsea Football Club aren't allowed to sell tickets or merchandise in their men's or women's franchises.
Yeah, I think also the men's team had to take a bus up to Northern England. I can't remember where they were playing, to be honest with you.
The North.
They'd have flown. Which is kind of hilarious to me. And I've watched some interviews with Chelsea fans who do make the an argument that I think is very fair, that there's plenty of clubs whose owners have similarly questionable backgrounds.
Sure.
The go-to example is Newcastle is owned by the Saudi royal family, effectively. Mm. I think it's owned via an investment fund of some sort. The Saudis are incredibly unpleasant. It's a very unpleasant regime or government they have in there. They've definitely done
unpleasant
stuff
is probably an understatement. Let's be fair.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, when Newcastle was bought by them off Mike Ashley, who owns Sports Direct, a lot of people said at the time, you know, should we be doing this? This is, you know, we're just enabling the laundering of reputations of, you know, questionable people. I mean, the whole, like, the fact that the next World Cup is going to be held in Qatar.
It's
another example of sports reputation mm-hmm. laundering.
Several hundred, I think it may be thousands of people have died in the labour that created that has built the stadiums.
Yeah, so they brought over loads of foreign construction workers and they treat them terribly. And as you say, loads of them have died. Mm. So football is absolutely rife with corruption and, you know, unpleasant characters, basically. And I guess, to say, you know, in Abramovich's defence, he's not the only one. But that's probably about the nicest thing you can say about him, I would say.
Mm. So there have been several kind of like potential buyers floating around, most of whom are either collections of businessmen or kind of like international franchise owners, loads of like famous names in the world of like sport and like the money of sport that I haven't bothered to remember. Interesting,
Sebco is probably the most prominent figure.
No, but he's also just part of a group of rich people.
Right, yeah.
Isn't he? But what I find really interesting is, like, apart from some of the bigger, like, American or international franchise owners, many of those looking to put in a bid are talking a lot about the importance of fan ownership.
Right, yeah.
Which is often talked about as a really wonderful thing for people to do, but I think is non-existent in the Premier League.
Yeah, I think it's in Germany's first league. There's a couple of teams that have significant fan ownerships.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm right in saying.
Yeah, I think... Oh, it's Barcelona as well? Maybe. But in the UK, none of the clubs, from what I understand, in the Premier League... are fan-owned. Do you think that is... Hey, what do you think of the positives of it? And do you think that it's a thing that we can... that will actually be viable in, like, the hyper commercialised Premier League?
Well, I'm not a huge... You know, I'm not a huge football fan. I'll watch, like, international games, and that's about the extent of it. So, in many ways, I don't have skin in the game. No pun intended. But... I do think it is a shame that these what are still really regarded as community assets, you know, things that are really important in terms of you know, so you look at say like teams like Sunderland or Newcastle, where they have massive local support. It genuinely is something that really binds towns together, and it really matters to people. I do think it is a shame on some level that it has been so overtaken by business interests, and you can see it in terms of like the ticket prices for certain games, you know, the fact that there's so much haggling over TV rights as well, in terms of international broadcasts. There's just so much money in the game now. And the upside for that, most people will say, is that the Premiership is, you know, some people would say the most exciting league to watch because there's so much money for international talent. So you have the best footballers in the world will come to the Premiership. And that would not be so readily available if we weren't so free and easy with, you know, allowing clubs to be owned by very rich people, including foreign oligarchs and billionaires and what have you. So there's definitely people that would say it has been good for the game in that respect. But I do, you know, the whole like European Super League thing, I think the fact there was so much backlash against that, and that was the plan for, you know, the best, the most prominent clubs in Europe to, you know, club together and form their own league away from the domestic league structure. And that went down really badly with loads of fans, because I think it was pushing in that direction away from being a game that's supposed to be about the fans and about the people who love it, and a game that is just about enriching certain commercial interests, mm-hmm. basically. So I you know, as far as I'm aware, there's other countries that do actually have fan-owned structures, although I'm pretty ignorant as to how those actually work. I think it's sort of similar to having like a seat on the board for employees of a company, which again Germany actually does. So I think it would be a good thing. I think that football clubs should not be treated purely as commercial assets. There's obviously commercial elements to their activities, and you know, there are plenty of people that say that's brought huge upsides for the game. And I guess from like a British cultural influence perspective, it's also good. You know, the Premiership is one of the most widely watched sporting competitions in the world. It might be the most widely watched one. And if you compare that to, say, the National Football League in America, which has far lower views around the world, you know, there's an argument about soft power there, which I guess is in our interest. But, this is one thing that I do kind of agree with Jeremy Corbyn on. That when he was leader of the Labour Party, he was pushing fan ownership, and I'm not knowledgeable enough about this area to detail how it would work, but I'm generally in favour of it, I would say.
Lovely.
Or more of it, let's say.
Well, I think that's very insightful, Jimmy. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I mean, as we mentioned, you're a Tottenham fan.
Yeah.
I don't know how strong a Tottenham fan you'd describe yourself as, but what do you make of all of this? You've been relatively restrained in your comments so far.
I think I broadly agree with you. I would love, in a dream scenario, I would love for there to be an enforcement of fan representation in a similar way that Sweden does it. So Sweden, I believe every football club has some kind of... they have to be owned by the fans. And they have voting rights and stuff. I know that I just looked up Barcelona, and Barcelona have like 150,000 socios who all have voting rights. And then like in response to that, they have like a lot of kind of like perks for tickets and stuff like that. I just think it's next to impossible to the connection that clubs used to have with, or the big clubs at the very least, that they used to have with their localities really seems to have been deteriorated. I live next to West Ham's football stadium, no one local goes. These are all people who are coming in from Essex and Kent and stuff like that. None of them are like people from Newham, where West Ham is based and has been based.
Presumably, in that case, it's partly because people who used to live have moved away. Yeah, so it's that kind of working class flight from the East End.
Yeah, but I think that the space for that is being filled by smaller, semi-amateur or semi-professional. Clubs like Leyton Orient has speaking about my local area again, Leyton Orient has a huge has financial troubles but is really popular locally, and there's kind of like Walthamstow FC, who are I have no idea what league they're in, but it's basically kind of like a semi-professional Sunday league that they do. And those are kind of like new spaces for that localized community that are filling the void left by the big clubs who are only really interested in kind of like the big international stuff at the moment. And I think that's a big shame, because they can be really transformative, the kind of work that clubs do in local areas.
I mean, I guess you could say, like, you know, when you compare the attendance of like some of those smaller clubs, which might be well supported in their own way, but you know, to the attendance of a Manchester United or an Arsenal game or what have you, clearly a lot of people do prefer to watch predominantly Premiership football, you know, despite the ownership structure and other sort of things, and the disassociation from their local communities as well. So you could say people are voting with their wallets is what I'm saying there, although it's a little hard to compare in many ways, because like Manchester United is not just a, it's not just a brand for Manchester, it's not just a brand for the UK, it's an international global brand that has supporters around the world. People will travel from like, you know, India and China to come and watch Manchester United play. So the comparison's a little bit difficult, I guess. But yeah, I mean, maybe you could also argue that there's room for both styles. You know, there's room for these kind of big commercial clubs that maybe have a slightly weaker local connection in many ways, and there's room for these more, this more grassroots stuff, and maybe they can coexist to a certain degree. But this is probably, I think we've strayed well out of my area of expertise at this point.
Excellent, good job. Well, it wouldn't be an episode without it.
So yeah, maybe we should stop there.
Awesome. Okie doke.
Yeah. Jazza, where can they find you on Twitter to insult your allegiance to Spurs?
Please do. Jazza John on all social media platforms.
You can find me at JDE Nichols, only on Twitter. Where, as Jazza says, I'm now taking down critics of Priti Patel in my spare time.
Oh, you're doing so well.
Yeah. It's good to give back to the community, I would say.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.